I'm Laurel Bowman, and here are some of the stories now related to the global coronavirus pandemic. The World Health Organization-led team investigating the origins of COVID-19 in China visited a hospital on Saturday in the central city of Wuhan. It's where some of the early coronavirus patients were treated. The visit is part of a discovery mission that has been tightly controlled by the Chinese hosts. On its second day, after 2 weeks in quarantine, the team went to the hospital where doctors had collected samples from patients suffering from an unidentified pneumonia in late 2019. Johnson & Johnson says that its single-dose vaccine was 66% effective in preventing COVID-19 in a large global trial against multiple variants. In the trial of nearly 44,000 volunteers, the level of protection against moderate and severe COVID-19 varied from 72% in the United States to 66% in Latin America and just 57% in South Africa, from where a worrying virus has spread. Novavax expects to produce up to 150 million COVID-19 vaccine doses monthly by May or June, its chief executive told Reuters after reporting data that showed its shot to be 89% effective in a UK trial. The company's CEO said Novavax expects to complete the clinical trial for its experimental COVID-19 vaccine in the next few weeks, but is already working on manufacturing to be able to reach full production capacity quickly. And Taiwan's government on Saturday reported the island's first death from COVID-19 since May, as it battles a small and unusual outbreak of locally transmitted cases. It was a woman in her 80s. And this is VOA News. Now for some other news making headlines around the world today. Indian farmers began a one-day hunger strike on Saturday in protest against new agricultural laws. The strike follows a week of clashes with authorities that left one dead and hundreds injured. Tens of thousands of farmers have been camped at protest sites on the outskirts of the capital, New Delhi, for over 2 months. They're angry at what they see as laws benefiting large private buyers at the expense of producers. The United Arab Emirates has adopted amendments that would allow the Gulf state to grant citizenship to investors and other professionals, including scientists, doctors, and their families, the government said on Saturday. Travelers to Iran from Europe will be required to self-quarantine for 2 weeks after testing negative upon arrival, a health official said Saturday. Travelers from other regions, including neighboring countries, will have to have tested negative before arrival in the country, a spokesman for the National Coronavirus Task Force said on state TV. Myanmar's military on Saturday said it would protect and abide by the country's constitution and act according to law amid concerns in the country that the armed forces might attempt to seize power. In an official statement, the military said recent remarks by its top generals about abolishing the constitution were misinterpreted by media and some other organizations. Vietnam reported 34 new COVID-19 infections early on Saturday in its latest coronavirus outbreak, and it seeks to accelerate procurement of vaccines. Of the new cases, 32 were detected in Haidong Province, which is the epicenter, and 2 in neighboring Quang Ninh Province, the Minister of Health said in a statement. It added that the country has recorded more than 1,700 cases since the disease was detected a year ago. The trade between Dubai and Israel has reached 1 billion dirham, or $270 million, over the last 5 months. The Dubai Media Office said on Saturday, Israel and the United Arab Emirates agreed in August to normalize diplomatic relations. And Ireland was not consulted by the European Commission before it briefly sought to restrict some exports of COVID-19 vaccines by invoking an emergency Brexit clause related to Northern Ireland, Ireland's European Affairs Minister said on Saturday. The EU abruptly reversed the plan to use the Article 16 clause to restrict exports after there was an uproar in Northern Ireland, London, and Dublin. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman for VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
The value of an environmental organization, of NGOs, not only for achieving impact in our own countries, but in strengthening the bonds between peoples all over the globe, because this is really work that reinforces the bond between Nigerian people and Dutch people.
A Dutch appeals court says the Nigerian subsidiary of the Royal Dutch Shell Oil Company is responsible for oil pipeline leaks in the Niger Delta.
Nigerians can be rest assured that on this particular issue, we are going to sustain pressure, we're going to follow each step that is required. And we're also in touch with Nigerians who are in diaspora, especially at The Hague. You know, there are things that will be done to make sure that the right thing is done on this subject matter.
A Nigerian political pressure group calls on the International Criminal Court, or the ICC, to investigate former chief of army staff over human rights abuses.
It means somebody will bring innovation in the government to be able to deliver with regard to what Congolese consider as being the fundamental priorities, meaning food, security, health, transportation, education, and job creation. These five are key.
And the under-pressure Prime Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, resigns following a parliamentary vote of no confidence. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A Dutch appeals court said that the Nigerian subsidiary of the Royal Dutch Shell Oil Company was responsible for oil pipeline leaks in the Niger Delta. The court ordered Shell to pay unspecified damages to farmers. The case was filed in 2008 by four farmers and their environmental group Friends of the Earth. They are seeking reparations for lost income from contaminated land and waterways in the Niger Delta region. Friends of the Earth hailed the ruling, saying it means people in developing countries can take on the multinationals who do them harm. For reaction, I reached Donald Pauls, CEO of Friends of the Earth in the Netherlands.
Yes, it's a phenomenal decision by the Dutch court. It's holding Shell accountable for the actions of its subsidiary and the mother company in the Netherlands for oil pollution and the impact it had on local communities and farmers in Nigeria. This is a landmark decision that will have an impact on Shell in the future and on other multinationals, both in the Netherlands and in Europe.
Donald, how significant is this ruling, particularly when this has been ongoing for some years now?
Yes, we have been fighting this legal battle for more than 13 years. So I'm enormously proud of the farmers in Nigeria that resisted the option of accepting a financial compensation from Shell, but made this an issue of principle. And therefore won this case. The first impact will be that Shell will need to financially compensate the farmers whose lives have been ruined by oil leakages by Shell. And the second is that this will have an impact on decisions by multinationals, Dutch multinationals, that act globally. This message from the court is very clear. Multinationals cannot continue acting with impunity in the business dealings in developing countries.
Some people are suggesting that the ruling also signifies that perhaps the lives of the Dutch is as important as the life of a Nigerian. Is this how your organization sees this?
Yes, this is the core of the ruling. In the past, Dutch multinationals could act with could tread the rights of people in developing countries, in this case in Nigeria, with impunity, without fearing any consequence. And the message of this court ruling is that the lives of Nigerians are of equal value to the lives of Dutch people. What Shell has done in Nigeria in the past decades would have been impossible in the Netherlands. Through their pollution, 16,000 children die annually because of the pollution. People live 10 years shorter in the Ogoni region than the rest of Nigeria, all because of the pollution, and this now has to end. Nigerian citizens, Nigerian people now are equal to Dutch people.
Donald, some people that I spoke with are of the view that this could affect the fortunes of multinational companies that are originally based in Netherlands and beyond, and that Nigerians could also be faced with investors trying not to invest in the country as a result of this ruling. Is that how you see this ruling?
People can continue to invest in Nigeria and the rest of the developing world, but they should recognize basic human rights and environmental norms. We all know that it's possible to do business while recognizing human rights and environmental norms, but now multinationals will be forced to do that or face the courts in their countries of where they're based.
So where does this leave the Friends of the Earth organization following this ruling that some see as a wind in your sails?
And I'm enormously proud of my organization. We have been fighting this battle for 13 years. Only the legal costs have been 1 million euro. But we have continued to fight this battle, even though it has been very difficult at times. And it proves that the value of an environmental organization, of NGOs, not only for achieving impact in our own countries, but in strengthening the bonds between peoples all over the globe, because this is really work that reinforces the bond between Nigerian people and Dutch people.
Donald Pauls is the CEO of Friends of the Earth in the Netherlands. He spoke with me from the capital, Amsterdam. Meanwhile, Concerned Nigerians, a political pressure group, is calling on the International Criminal Court, or the ICC, to launch an official investigation into violence and human rights abuses under former Chief of Army Staff Lieutenant Colonel Tukur Yusuf Burutai. The group says the recent removal of the head of the army paves the way for the Hague-based court to launch an independent inquiry. This after the group petitioned ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda. The political pressure group accuses the former army chief of playing a role in the extrajudicial killings carried out by soldiers in the fight against militant groups, including Boko Haram. But some Nigerians dismiss the accusations as false. They say the army chief was doing his job after he and other top security officials were tasked with combating terrorism, as well as improving the security situation in the country. But Deji Adeyanju, convener of the Concerned Nigerian group, tells me that somebody must be held accountable for the deaths of innocent civilians who were killed in the fight against militant groups.
Yes, basically the petition is one of the very many things we intend to do on this subject matter. You know, we just want to officially notify the ICC of the general yearnings of many Nigerians who have been waiting patiently, ourselves included, for a time like this, when General Burutai will be relieved of his appointment or his term in office will expire. You know that he's one of the longest serving chief of army staff in the history of our country, perhaps for about 66 months. And so many atrocities happened under his watch, from the Zaria massacre in 2015, where so many Shiites were murdered in cold blood, in a week-long assault against freedom of assembly and freedom or right to worship. Again, we saw a continuation of that with the killing of several members of the Indigenous People of Biafra, popularly referred to as IPOB, where many of them were massacred in Onitsha and several other parts of the southeast. Even just 2 days ago, many members of the IPOB and even members of the community were also massacred and killed in the southeast, precisely in Olu in Imo State. Again, we also witnessed under his watch the massacre of protesters in Lekki and in Oshodi Agbiz during the EndFAS campaign. So this is the locus for which this official petition has been written.
Now, Deji, some people are suggesting that why do you go to the International Criminal Court when the our courts in Nigeria, competent courts in Nigeria, to handle such a petition?
Yeah, there are no competent courts in Nigeria that can handle such petitions because the allegations against Buratai borders on crimes against humanity. That's number one. And you know, within the context of crimes against humanity, only the ICCJ can try such cases. Again, it also borders on issues around genocide, because genocide does not mean that you have to kill hundreds of people. That once you target a particular people of a religious sect, or a tribal or an ethnic sect, because of their religious belief or even political belief, then you'll be guilty of genocide. The defense of Buratai, in response to killing of Shiites in Zaria in 2015, official figures by government admitted by the military was 200 and something. The Shiites have come out to say over 1,000 of their members were killed. His defense is that the Shiites dare to touch the chest of a general. So these are some of the explanations that Tukur Buratai will be expected to explain when he honors the ICCJ's invitation, or maybe if an international arrest warrant is issued to against him to Interpol. So there are questions that must be answered.
Some Nigerians are saying that by going to the ICC, you are basically undermining the independence of the Nigerian judiciary, and that your case probably might not meet the threshold of the ICC to come and investigate, because they say
people have been investigated. People have been investigated for the death of 10 people at the ICCJ. Not to talk more of 300 and something people, 100 and something people, IPOB members, 300 and something Shiites, NSAS protesters. What are we talking about? Where is our humanity, for God's sake? Which court in Nigeria has jurisdiction to entertain crimes against humanity or genocide? Which court in Nigeria? Just name one. So people will always say, especially the beneficiaries, the enablers, the supporters of the tyranny that we have witnessed, and the flagrant abuse, you know, and assault on human rights in the country. People who are benefiting will always say, somebody will always have somebody something to say. Even the devil has fun. So why wouldn't Tukur Buratai have fun?
What is next for you? What is next for your group now?
Yes, you know, for us, we are determined, we are committed to ensuring that the right thing is done at all times. One thing that we can assure you and the Nigerian people is that there must be consequences for bad behavior. And the reason why we are going to see this Buratai issue to a logical conclusion is so that the new service chiefs and those who will come after them, we know that you cannot just arbitrarily do whatever you like and you say it in public, that you encourage soldiers to commit right abuses. Buratai said in open floor to the press, don't worry about ICC. Go ahead and discharge your work. Do anything you like. So such behaviors is what we are trying to ensure that they never happen again. That citizens, you know, do not get to witness a situation where people who pay their taxpayers' money are not used to kill the same people paying these taxes. So for us, Nigerians can be rest assured that on this particular issue, we are going to sustain pressure. We're going to follow each step that is required. And we're also in touch with Nigerians who are in diaspora, especially at The Hague. You know, there are things that will be done to make sure that the right thing is done on this subject matter.
Deji Adeyanju is the convener of the Concerned Nigerian Group. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. The Democratic Republic of Congo's Prime Minister Sylvester Ilunga Ilunkamba stepped down Friday. This after he submitted his resignation letter to President Felix Tshisekedi. He had come under pressure after parliamentarians passed a vote of no confidence in the government this week. Analysts say the resignation could enable the president to choose a new prime minister to carry out his constitutional mandate without any hindrance from a coalition partner. The president had formed an alliance with former President Joseph Kabila 2 years ago. Herbert Kabasu Babu Katulondi is an author, a former governor of the Kasai province, and a political analyst. He tells me that the resignation will enable President Tshisekedi to choose his own people to help him effectively administer the affairs of the country.
Well, I believe that this is a great day where the Congolese have again shown to the world that they are capable of transcending whatever differences they have to go ahead to allow the country to progress, because everybody was saying that Kabila was being constituted an obstacle to the power of Mr. Tshisekedi. So now Kabila has decided to really let go. So now we'll be talking about a total alternation in power, meaning President Tshisekedi running the country entirely. He has got a prime minister of his own choosing. So I think it's a great day. In peace, in love, let Mr. Tshisekedi run the country. Let him instrumentalize all the powers, executive, judicial, parliamentary. Maybe he's got something to do. And I think Mr. Kabila has shown elegance, political elegance, in letting go.
Are Congolese embracing this latest development? Because some people were suggesting that the coalition between former President Kabila's party and his party basically prevented him from effectively running the affairs of the country. So how are Congolese reacting to this news?
Well, from what I can because where I'm staying is in the middle of the city, I don't hear any celebration. But I believe that the Congolese have been fed, have been hearing discourse that Mr. Kabila is actually hindering, impeding the running of the country by Mr. Tshisekedi, which is a debatable thesis because, as you know very well, when Mr. Tshisekedi took over in 2019, he ran the country alone for like 9 months. He took all the decisions, financial. He launched a 100-day program worth $400 million, which led to the embezzlement of $57 million by his chief of staff. So that thesis, people say, okay, that's what he said. But now Kabila has relinquished all the powers. So let him see. Let's see what he's down the road. Let him see what he has got as a new formula, as innovation, as capacity of state management and performance to see how the Congo is going to move toward development. I think it's a great day to manage this immense country.
What should be the expectations of Congolese now that it appears that President Tshisekedi would have his own prime minister and seem to have a new backing in parliament?
No, actually, as you know, the Mr. Kabila's coalition, FCC, has been emphasizing the necessity to comply with the constitution because as the Congolese system operates, the bylaw of the National Assembly, you cannot switch the majority in the running of a legislature because it's after the election. Actually, it's the people through the vote, through the ballot, who allocate the majority to a certain component. You cannot, in the middle of a legislature, as you know, people were bribed. There was rampant corruption in the parliament to get people to switch loyalty. So now that Mr. Tshisekedi, as I was emphasizing, as was the case in the Mobutu, now will control the National Assembly, and I believe that he will also trigger maneuver to topple the Speaker of the Senate, because the Speaker of the Senate is still a Kabila loyalist. The Congolese expect him to run the country in a way that will produce added, wealth, so that it can take care, it can respond to the problems. We've got serious problems of food, we've got a shortage of food. We've got major, major dramatic problem of security in the east. This morning, again, I saw some soldiers who came from Goma demonstrating in the street saying they were not paid for the last 6 months.
What should be the expectation of the new prime minister that will soon be chosen by the president?
This prime minister, I think, on the agenda, number one focus, number one priority, or propose the restructuring of the higher echelon of the army. That's number one. Equipping the Congolese army, because these guys need serious firepower to overwhelm the adversary there, in the terrorists there in the east. People expect this new prime minister to be somebody who will bring innovation in the government, to be able to deliver with regard to what Congolese consider as being the fundamental priorities, meaning food, security, health, transportation, education, and job creation. These five are key.
Herbert Kabasu Babu Katolondi is an author, a former governor of the Kasai province, and a political analyst. He spoke with me from the DRC capital, Kinshasa. Analysts say South Sudanese President Salva Kiir's remarks in the capital, Juba, when he closed the Jonglei State and Pibor Administrative Area Peace Conference is disturbing. The president told the participants that his government will not intervene to stop future intercommunal violence in the two areas. Augustino Tingmayai, a policy analyst and researcher with the CERT Institute, says he hopes the two communities will not take President Kiir's remarks as a license to continue fighting themselves. For VOA, David Mono Danga reports from the South Sudanese capital, Juba.
Addressing delegates to the Jonglei State and Pibor Administrative Area Peace Conference in Juba on Wednesday, President Salva Kiir said the national government will not intervene should conflict break out again among communities in Jonglei State.
Next time when you go and fight, I will not come to your rescue again, nor form a committee to go to the war zone. The few soldiers I have, I will bring them close to me and encircle myself with the soldiers and police. And then I see where you will come from. Whoever is chased will be the one to come here. So I have decided that any other fighting that erupts, I won't send either soldiers nor the police. I will leave you to fight yourselves until one section runs from the other.
Augustino Tingmayai, a researcher and policy analyst with the CERT Institute, says he hopes the president misspoke because everybody looks to him to resolve national issues, including deadly conflicts in South Sudan.
It was very unfortunate to hear that he would give up in making sure that security is restored in these communities. It's basically a signal. I'm sure it wasn't intended that way, but it signals the state's inability to basically monopolize violence. And that should be concerning for all of us, the citizens of the country. Should we take the security of our own in our own hands, which is what's happening across the country, then the question is, why should the state exist?
Mayai says he hopes communities will not perceive Kiir's remarks as permission to attack each other.
Hopefully the communities actually find a courage to come together and bring peace among themselves and restore what has been lost in the last, say, 15 years since South Sudan became a regional autonomy as well as becoming a state. Because otherwise, what else do we exist for if there's no peace?
James Okuk, a senior research fellow and policy analyst at the Center for Strategic Policy Studies in Juba, says he does not find Kiir's remarks surprising since the government has not provided protection or other services to its citizens for quite a while now.
That's why we have the UNMISS in the country doing some of those duties. So it's not a new thing, and it's not surprising because it has been for some time now that people take care of themselves. So the same way they have been taking care for themselves for some time now, I think as human beings, they will find a way how to survive and move on. So if they see that escalation is not good for their survival, they will stop it.
Jame David Kolok, Executive Director for the Local Advocacy Group, Foundation for Democracy and Accountable Governance, says President Kiir is frustrated with political community-level conflicts that continue despite the signing of the 2018 Revitalized Peace Agreement. But Kolok says intercommunal clashes have become hugely militarized, which require government intervention.
If the president says that he will never dispatch his forces, neither the police, to be able to confront any emerging threat, that to us, in other words, would actually promote or encourage communities now to fight.
Kolok says Kiir should correct his statement.
We expect him to actually say the government is ready to confront any emerging threat that will disorganize this kind of peace conferences and peace negotiations that we have. So I think it is ideal that that statement is actually reversed or corrected. Otherwise, we are going to see massive resistance toward emerging community threats across the communities in South Sudan.
As a head of state, analysts say President Kiir should be encouraging dialogue and peaceful negotiations between warring communities rather than turning a blind eye to their problems. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Tanzanian opposition parties are praising the Catholic Secretariat of the Episcopal Conference over its warning to congregants to protect themselves from the coronavirus. It urged them to pray while also encouraging them to practice social distancing and other medical measures being practiced globally to limit the spread of the disease. This after the church stated in its newspaper Friday that there is corona. The statement sharply contradicts President John Magufuli. He recently expressed doubt about the efficacy of the coronavirus vaccine and said God had eliminated the disease in the East African country. In a recent speech, the president also scorned the idea of a lockdown to prevent the coronavirus from spreading. For analysis on the latest development, I reach Faraja Lugome, a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam.
Some of the people see President Magufuli as a nationalist, as a patriot, as a leader who can lead them through this crisis. And they think Magufuli has taken the right approach to tell Tanzanians that vaccine has some hidden impacts, or has some, or those people who prepare or who crusade for vaccine in Tanzania or in Africa in general have an ulterior motive. But there are those who are a bit skeptical about his approach on COVID-19 and vaccine in general. There are people who think Dr. John Pombe Magufuli could allow medical practitioners to be free to practice their profession and to advise Tanzanians properly. So, in fact, generally, the general public has been divided concerning what Magufuli is taking as an action towards combating COVID-19 in our country.
But Faraja, if there's concern of a dispute pitting one Tanzanian against the other, believing what they could believe, despite the fact that you have the presence of coronavirus in Tanzania, doesn't this defeat the purpose of limiting the spread of the disease in Tanzania?
So far, Peter, we can't say exactly that what is the status of corona in Tanzania, because no statistics have been shared by the authorities. And so we have been always guessing based on the sufferings that people are going through. We see people developing symptoms like those of corona. And it's because of that people have been suspicious that maybe this disease is taking our lives, is taking the lives of our friends, of our relatives. But in fact, most of us believe the government could take strong action by telling people what is going on and many other steps that can protect them from contacting COVID-19. Otherwise, we have been always living, maybe I can say, in the state of not knowing what is happening in our community or in our society, because the data are not shared by the authorities.
Talking about not knowing the situation of what is going on with regards to the disease in Tanzania, I'm sure you are aware that the Tanzanian Episcopal Conference issued a statement urging Catholic faithfuls to protect themselves against the virus, including resorting to prayer, social distancing, hand washing, and sanitizing. So isn't this a caution that the acknowledge that the disease or coronavirus exists in Tanzania in spite of the position of the government?
The statement released by Tanzania Episcopal Conference proves to us that the fear is there, and even the religious leaders are now aware of the fear, are now aware of the situation. They understand that their people need to be protected. And The Catholic Church in Tanzania is one of the strongest institutions that has been existing, that has been so bold to tell government sometimes that when things are not okay, they will always tell the government that things are not okay. And so sometimes if the government is not taking heed to what they advise, they will always advise the followers that please listen to what we tell you. This is the situation. And if you heard the Secretary General of Tanzania Episcopal Conference, Father Charles Kitima, told the press that in fact they have learned from the neighboring countries like Zambia. The youngest bishop had passed away. Even in Tanzania, some of the priests, several priests have been reported to have passed away because of the signs of COVID-19, although it hasn't been proved yet by the authorities that they passed away because of COVID-19, but they developed the signs similar to COVID-19, and that's why the Catholic Church has been so conscious about what is happening. Its people have been affected, have been dying. So the church knows what is happening. Although they understand the president's position is not to tell people about the existence of COVID-19, rather to take precaution. So the church understands the position of the president, and that's why it has decided to take its own course of action.
Faraj Alugume is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam. He spoke with me from the Tanzanian commercial capital, Dar es Salaam. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, or ICRC, is appealing for $30 million to respond to the humanitarian crisis brought by the conflict in the Ethiopian Tigray region. The ICRC is also appealing to donors for an additional $22 million to urgently expand its response to the acute humanitarian needs in and around Tigray. For VOA, Nabil Biagio has more from Washington.
The IFRC and International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, are providing food, water, shelter, and healthcare to millions of internally displaced people, refugees, and host communities affected by the unfolding crisis in Ethiopia. At a virtual joint news conference yesterday, ICRC's head of delegation in Ethiopia, Katia Sorin, said her organization needs additional funding to keep providing essential and life-saving assistance to people affected by the war in Tigray.
The ICRC is scaling up its response and presence in Tigray, launching a budget appeal for 20 million Swiss francs. We will do so while maintaining our humanitarian activities in other violence affected areas of Ethiopia as per our national program. This is very important for ICRC to continue implementing our mandate and activities as previously planned.
The war in the Tigray region, which erupted in early November, has affected some 3 million people, according to the Ethiopian Red Cross Society. The violence also forced tens of thousands of refugees across the border into neighboring Sudan and Djibouti. Sorin says part of their work is to reunite separated families who cross into Sudan and provide health services in refugee camps inside Sudan.
In eastern Sudan, ICRC works with the Sudanese Red Crescent to respond to the restoring family links needs of refugees from Tigray. We will also assist two health structures and the Kassala Teaching Hospital, one of the region's referral hospitals, to enable them to continue to provide adequate medical care to host communities and incoming sick or wounded refugees without being overwhelmed.
John Roach is the head of Country Cluster Eastern Africa for the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Society. He says the conflict in Tigray is struck at a very bad time when the entire region of the Horn of Africa is struggling with multiple challenges.
It's a confluence of crises which are mutually exacerbating and continues to unfold in the eastern Horn of Africa from a region on a scale that we've rarely seen in decades. There are more than 22 million people severely or what we would call severely food secure across the region of Ethiopia, Kenya, Somalia, South Sudan and Sudan. And the prognosis over the next months is not great, as we fear droughts, a drought. So these numbers will only increase.
Roj says the situation is further exacerbated by the invasion of desert locusts in Ethiopia, Uganda and South Sudan, as well as the COVID-19 pandemic.
Our emergency appeal seeks a total of 27 million Swiss francs. This will enable the IFRC to support the Ethiopian Red Cross, the Sudanese Red Crescent and the Djibouti Red Crescent to deliver humanitarian assistance and recovery support to some 660,000 people, internally displaced refugees and host communities, for a period of up to 18 months.
Roj says the IFRC urgently needs the funding to carry out disaster risk reduction, livelihood services, and to provide basic services such as water and sanitation. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Washington.
Threats to African journalists are nothing new, but the African Union is partnering with the United Nations to track and monitor threats to African journalists in a bid to improve protections for media workers. VOA's Anita Power reports from Johannesburg.
Six African journalists were killed in 2020, according to the International Federation of Journalists. Countless more were threatened, arrested, harassed, and censored, according to several media freedom and human rights groups. That, the African Union is now saying, has to stop. And to do that, they're making use of journalists' most powerful tool, facts. A new AU website, www.safetyofjournalistsinafrica.africa, launched Friday and will now track threats to African journalists. Here's Jovial Rantau, chairman of the African Editors Forum, invoking the memories of fallen colleagues.
We stand on the shoulders of these giants, these heroes of the media in Africa, in whose name we today launch this platform that is designed to help end the harassment, detention, and even murder of journalists just for doing their work. In some of our beloved continent, freedom of the media, freedom of expression, access to information is a matter of life and death.
Rantau and his colleagues readily admit that journalists are often the irritating characters who lurk in the halls of power to shout tough questions at important people. There are also figures like Zimbabwean investigative journalist Hopewell Chinono, who was recently granted bail after 3 weeks in prison. He was charged with communicating falsehoods after he tweeted that police had beaten an infant to death while enforcing COVID-19 lockdown regulations. As South African President Cyril Ramaphosa argues, you don't have to like journalists or their work to support this initiative.
It requires that we vigorously defend the right of journalists to do their work, to write, to publish, and to also broadcast what they like. Even if we disagree with some or all of it, Africa is on the march to entrench a culture of human rights, of democracy, gender equality, inclusion, peace, prosperity, security for all our citizens, and unfettered media freedom and independence. The digital platform for the safety of journalists in Africa is an important tool in promoting the safety of journalists and other media workers across Africa.
But media freedom advocates were quick to point out that doesn't mean journalists are without responsibilities. At the virtual launch of the website, media freedom advocates spoke of Félicien Kabuga, founder of Rwanda's infamous Radio Télévision Libre de Mille Collines. That's the broadcaster whose reporters actively encouraged Rwandans to participate in the 1994 genocide that killed more than 800,000 people. Kabuga's use of the platform to spew hatred and incite violence has led him to prison in The Hague. The head of the AU African Governance Architecture Secretariat, Salah Hamad, says the AU draws a direct line between honest journalism and robust, peaceful societies.
So when we are talking about the rights of people, the rights of human and people's rights in Africa, we cannot really exclude media freedom as well as right to expression and right to freedom of expression as well as right to information. And the African Union, in its Constitutive Act, clearly indicated that the African Union in totality is very supportive, of course, of the promotion and protection of these rights.
The platform will help keep a focus on continuing violations, like the January 19th shooting death of an Ethiopian broadcaster in the conflict-racked Tigray region. The Independent Ethiopian Human Rights Council says that the journalist Dawit Kebede Araya and a friend were killed execution-style by security forces. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Life is too short, I know if you waste time, oh. Where they up at this, why on earth they sleep, make you wake up, oh. Who they call me, if you know the party, call me later, oh. If your girlfriend no go, go, call your side chick, it makes a link, oh, go. Someone knows I'm anti-buffet and I will go get cake. Fine, fine, guess be what she say, yeah. On your champagne, now, you'll go be where man catch up a crime and pay me tea. Yeah, le party, yeah. And then, you drink, yeah. I'm in the yalan, I'm in the temp. On the phone, I will do that thing in a move. Yes, I'm in the yalan, I'm in the demo. Yeah, let you move too fast, I'm in the move. I'm in the yalan, I'm in the temp. Party after party,
enjoy your life because problem is not the finish. Leave me make I chop life, I'm no speaker for English. Brother, I know lazy, I work hard for this life. So I go chop on like party your love, party your love. Eh. Me and me mademoiselle, like Obama and Michelle. We go, they do very well. Up, I'm well. Champagne is just for the pain. I'm about to make it rain. Given the miskin pain. I wanna do this again. As you can see, everything fair, fair, fair. No be lie, sweetie, sweetie. Yeah, fair, 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 fair. I tell you. Oh, yeah, baby, oh. Oh, la, mu, yeah, yeah, yeah. Kofi Kinata, Papi Rankin and Sisi Nete.
I'm in Mayala, I'm in that temp. Enjoy my life for me. Baby, come and shake body. My party money or no money. But me give me you want to know body. Who come and enjoy my life for me. Baby, come and shake body. My party money or no money. Any day, it's Mama Mindy Biana.
I'll catch up.
What's that to ya? Mama Mindy Biana. Usher free Jimo. No, so Mama Mono Mana. Ah, so now Jenny, you woo.
Nabakasa bitana bibazikiride kali kubonya changa mukwano tumire no mwambi wangoli kwenjagala bitekere hallo inze boya gala kwa gala tali kuyombera hallo inze boya gala kwa gala tali kuranira sagala konomia sechi musagala konomia kwemanya ndi mulafu na ino siloko katusaba no mvuyo timu no simba tulino kwekana omulala lwafunye moja wenga wera nkolokota kutematema nkugambo musajja kwata kozesa wuyo bakuwa musala.
Easy. polisi wangu we. Nikaimbia polisi. Na nikaimba soma, soma, soma. Uye, na nikasema popote ulipo. Mina kuwaza mama. Uko 50 bado unakaa fiti. Yeah, you can get it. Ooh, yeah.
Heaven and mine. When I close my eyes I see your face. Uzuri wako I can't compare. Mapenzi ya kweli wali ndona nipa uwe. Sija ona kama uwe kote liko pita mye. The love that you give me is taking me far away. Nachotaka niko wana wewe milele. Maaba ni uwe kwenye ponde kama nyanya. Naka kosi chapu para. Maaba ni uwe kwenye ponde kama nyanya.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when the lion is crippled, the hare goes to his house for debt recovery. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.